The Exchange Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. This week, NHPR's health reporter Jack Rodolico has dug deeper into a troubling headline from this past fall. Reports of severe abuse and neglect at a facility for people with developmental disabilities called Lakeview. In a series of reports, Jack outlined some chilling stories that emerged from an investigation by the New Hampshire Disability Rights Center, incidents of alleged abuse that led Governor Hassan in September to order a stop to new admissions at Lakeview. The facility is small, serving fewer than 88 children and adults with severe disabilities and often equally severe mental health problems, but it's part of a larger system in New Hampshire where the goal is to treat and care for Granite Staters with disabilities in the least restrictive environment possible. Today in The Exchange, we look at that system, how it works, how it's supposed to work, and why incidents that seem to have occurred at Lakeview still happen. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests include Jack Rodolico, as I said, NHPR's health and science reporter. You can find his series on Lakeview at nhpr.org. And Jack, thank you for making time out for us today.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
Also with us, Professor Joan Beasley, Research Associate Professor with the UNH Institute on Disability. She joins us today from Boston. And Professor Beasley, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate
it. Thank you.
Also with us, Dick Cohen, Executive Director of the Disability Rights Center. And Dick, nice to see you. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us, Roy Gerstenberger, Executive Director of Community Bridges, one of several nonprofits that contracts with the state to provide services for New Hampshire residents with disabilities. Roy, it's nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Laura.
Well, and Jack, I did want to start with you, but obviously go to everybody. New Hampshire's goal for a long time, as I said, has been to care for people with disabilities in the least restrictive setting possible, preferably right at home with their families. So who would be placed at Lakeview and why?
So Lakeview is almost an indication of where the system – where there's some cracks in the system, right? Because as you said, the goal is to treat people in the least restrictive environment possible. So when the local resources run out for an individual, when the system just kind of can't handle their needs in that particular moment, they will wind up in a more restrictive environment. They might wind up at Lakeview. They might wind up at a facility outside of New Hampshire. People know the name Crotchet Mountain. That's another place, Easter Seals. There are several locations in the state and outside of the state. But the thing about Lakeview is that Lakeview started off 20 years ago as a facility for people with traumatic brain injury, very specific type of issue, although it's very diverse what can happen when you have a traumatic brain injury. But over the years, as the state has developed a need for services with highly complex developmental disabilities, Lakeview has sort of stepped into that role. So right now what you've got at Lakeview and over the past few years, people with not only a developmental disability, which is the kind of thing you might be born with, such as Asperger's syndrome, but also people with a mental illness. So I've spoken with parents around the country who have kids at Lakeview who have both autism, Asperger's is on the higher end of that spectrum, so I've talked to them too, and bipolar disorder or other mental illnesses. So these individuals' needs are so complex. And often, not always, but I've talked with a lot of parents who say their children can be violent. Adults, that's not everyone at Lakeview. I don't mean to throw that stigma on people, but I've talked with a lot of parents who say that their kids, the turning point for their child was when they became aggressive, when they became violent. And so when you've got an individual that can't be served in the community because that particular community, whether it's the school district, whether it's the local clinicians like doctors and psychiatrists, just can't provide the level of help that they need, that person winds up being hospitalized, maybe in a psych ward, they just wind up going down the pike to a place like Lakeview.
Yeah, so it's important that you're making that distinction, because we're going to say the term developmental disability a lot this hour, Jack, and it's important to talk about what kind of conditions we are putting under that framework and what we aren't. It sounds like things are getting meshed, that there's some developmental disabilities, but also some mental illness.
Correct. Yeah. Somebody wouldn't wind up at Lakeview if they exclusively have a mental illness, from my understanding, but they could wind up if they exclusively have a developmental disability or a developmental disability and a mental illness. I think people get those terms confused, but we'll talk about it over the next hour, why it's important to think of them a little bit differently.
Well, and Roy, I want to turn to you. You've been working in this system of providing services for people with developmental disabilities for more than 3 decades, mm-hmm. you told me before we got on the air. How would you describe this system broadly?
Well, broadly, I think that one of the things to point out is that people with intellectual disabilities are supported in New Hampshire in the community. And our system is not what we are doing is assisting people in living full lives in the community. It's not a treatment service system per se. It's a system that's designed to make sure that people are full members of their community, that they're able to live out their hopes and dreams, and that they get the assistance they need to be part of the community and have relationships. There is a percentage of people with intellectual disability, just as there's a percentage in the general population, who experience mental health issues. There's a percentage that experience other types of characteristics. Those are the folks, just like, again, in the general population, who need intensive treatment services, hopefully for a fixed period of time, with the intention that they will eventually return to full lives in the community.
So it's not forever if you end up at a facility.
Exactly, exactly. And when we're talking about disability is a natural part of the human experience. People around, all of the four of us around this table, experience disability at some level. If we were to come back in a year and have a reunion session, there would be more disability at this table. I mean, the fact is that it's part of all of our lives. And it's something that we acquire as we age. So we're not talking about those people, the other. We're talking about members of our community who are living in the community because of the developmental services system that New Hampshire has created, who occasionally need intensive treatment service in very specialized treatment programs that are designed around evidence-based practices.
Well, so here's the big broad question. I'll throw it to you first, Professor Beasley. Does this system that Jack and Roy Gerstenberger describe, in general, does it do a good job or not in New Hampshire? What do you think?
I think it does a good job to a certain extent, and then we're continuing to work on it. Part of what Roy just said, which is a very important point, is that the treatment that people should be getting in facilities such as this are evidence-based practices. It seems clear to me, for example, that at Lakeview, that those practices, those evidence-based practices, were not actively engaged. And as a result, people did not get the treatment that they needed. And I think part of the lack in the system is oversight and understanding about what those evidence-based practices should be, what they look like, and how to actively monitor them.
What does that mean, evidence-based practices? Can you put that in layperson terms, please, Professor?
Sure. Evidence-based practices are practices or treatment services that are provided where research has been done, data has been collected, and there is a clear understanding of what works and what doesn't work, so that when it's used, you have some sense and some understanding that those practices will be helpful to people. For example, one of the things that Jack has cited in several of his reports are the multiple diagnoses that people have received. And one of the things that we know in looking at this work nationally and in New Hampshire in our collaboration with Roy and other area agencies in New Hampshire is that practices even to diagnose people have not been evidence-based so that it can set you on the wrong track to begin with.
So when you're on the, yeah, okay. So even the if the diagnosis isn't good and then you're on the
then
wrong
the
track for treatment.
Then the treatment's not going to work.
Got
right.
it. Okay.
Right. And the other thing that Jack said, which is I think very important, is that when you have a system where somebody goes somewhere at a default instead of what Roy described, so they described sort of the dichotomy, the goal would be, as Roy said, somebody has a treatment need, you know that there's a facility that employs evidence-based practices, and you send someone there, and you know that they know what they're doing, and you have faith and trust that they will do the work and that your child will return home. The other end of the spectrum is no one knows what to do. This is the only people who are willing to do anything. So you send people there not really knowing what you're going to get, and not really knowing how it's going to end up.
Yeah, so you kind of cross your fingers and hope it turns out okay, but you don't really know.
Don't
I want to
really
invite
know.
Our listeners to join us as well, and then a ton more questions for all of you. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Calling in from Portland, Oregon is Ed. Hi, Ed. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning. So I have a son who has been at Lakeview over 2 years. He's on the autism spectrum. He's in the pervasive developmental disorder corner of that. And he has been very successful at Lakeview, and we've frankly had no issues with Lakeview.
How old is your son, Ed?
He has just turned 18.
He's just turned 18. And how long has he been at Lakeview again? You said 2 years?
About 2 years.
Yeah. And so I'm sure you've heard all the reports, the Disability Rights Center here in New Hampshire filing, doing an investigation into reports of abuse and so forth. What do you make of that, given your experience and given that your son is there?
We've read the report rather extensively. My wife and I have read the report rather extensively. You know, frankly, the Disability Rights Center has an agenda to move this kind of care locally. And I can tell you from our experience here in Oregon, there is really no local facility like Lakeview that can provide the kind of treatment that he's getting. So we did a nationwide search looking for places, and the place that came up at the top of the list was Lakeview, and he's been very successful there. Frankly, here in Oregon, we have our choice of facility, either one that has razor wire or one that has barbed wire.
Wow. Okay. Ed, thank you so much for calling in. Good to hear your experience. And Dick Cohen, I will go to you after a short break. I want to remind everyone that you can join us as well, like Ed did, from Portland, Oregon or not. 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Today in the exchange, we're looking at how we care for Granite Staters with disabilities and some of the issues that have come up recently, given Jack Rodolico's reporting on the Lakeview situation. We'd love to hear from you, your questions, comments, personal experiences like Ed's. 1-800-892-6477. Keep it right here. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking about caring for people in New Hampshire with developmental disabilities and some problems in that system. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have four guests this hour looking at this system. Jack Rodolico's here, NHPR's health and science reporter. He recently completed a series on a facility called Lakeview that has had some serious allegations leveled against it. Also with us, Roy Gerstenberger, Executive Director of Community Bridges, a nonprofit that provides services for residents with developmental disabilities. Also with us, Dick Cohen, Executive Director of the Disability Rights Center, and Professor Joan Beasley, Research Associate Professor with the UNH Institute on Disability. And Dick Cohen, I did want to give you a chance to both give your broad thoughts on the system, how well it's working or not working, but also to respond to Ed in Portland, Oregon's comment. He's had a great experience with his son at Lakeview, and he feels like your organization, which has been very critical, has an agenda.
Yeah, I can't speak to his son's particular situation. The mission of our organization is to make sure that people are free from abuse and neglect, people are safe, whether they're in the community or in a place like Lakeview, and also to advocate for people to be in a least restrictive environment. And as Roy said, that's to, in effect, lead rich and full lives in the community. And people with mild, moderate, and even very severe disabilities can do that, and including people with significant behavioral issues. We've proven that in New Hampshire, and we've proven it elsewhere.
Can you give an example, Dick, that would help people understand what you mean about least restrictive, even with severe behavioral
sure.
issues?
Sure. Well, there was a fellow, actually, one of the things that triggered our work was a young man who died at Lakeview in a very, very tragic circumstances, which is detailed in our report. He was someone with mental health issues and developmental disabilities. I won't say where he was living because of confidentiality, but was living with another individual in what's called enhanced family care, and that can take many forms. This was with kind of a roommate, a peer, who was another young man, although a bit older, who also was well-trained, was having a great life in the city. That person had to leave to attend to his family, that is the caretaker, and his life fell apart. So he was able, because he had really good supports, he had good evaluations, they knew what would trigger some of his behaviors, and he was very well managed. Something fell apart in his life, like it happens with all of us, and then he, because of his mental illness, kind of went downhill quickly. So with the right kinds of supports, and some of it is not necessarily clinical. Some of it does have to be clinical. Like, for example, sometimes we need psychiatrists or therapists, just like people with developmental disabilities. So it can be a small group home. One of the things that we were awarded or recognized for was that in 1991, we did not have a setting, very few settings, more than three individuals per setting. Most people are living one or two or three. There's nothing magical about something large like Lakeview at 85 or Laconia State School at 600. In fact, that's counterproductive because you can't do the individualization. You certainly can't get people living rich lives in the community if you're living in an isolated facility of 85. So that's a good example. In terms of this agenda issue, we're very proud of the fact that we're trying to push in that direction. That's what the law requires, the Americans with Disabilities Act. That's what New Hampshire has required since 1975 with the passage of our law, which predated the ADA. And we're not the only ones who have found these problems. OSHA came in. New York came in. Our own investigative authorities came in. We were only one of multiple reports. The problem was our licensing authority in Lakeview ignored all of these reports. It just didn't come from DRC. And there were hundreds of documented incidents.
DRC, again, being Disability Rights Center.
Correct.
You talked about that in your stories, too. One more quick question for you, Dick, and then I do want to hear from everybody. I asked Professor Beasley, and I'd like to ask you, too, the same question, Dick. Do you think, in general, broadly, that the system here in New Hampshire for caring for people with developmental disabilities is doing a good job or not? I know that's a very broad
sure.
question, but I'd love your thoughts.
Yeah, it is a tough question. The system sort of intensely serves about 4,500 people. There are more that they serve episodically with respite care and so forth, which is giving parents a break. But there are 4,500 that are served. There are about 600 or so that have really intense needs that sort of Roy outlined. It might have major behavioral issues as well as medical issues in addition to their intellectual or developmental disability. The system has really eroded over the past 15 years. These people were much better supported, ironically, 15 to 20 years ago than they are now. These people do need clinical interventions at times. They do need supports. And that can be done in fact, an evidence-based practice is to actually do that in the community where you can individualize more and not put people in a Laconia State School or a Lakeview-type setting.
A bigger facility.
That's right. In terms of the rest of the population, it is mixed. I think we can do more even for folks with more moderate and mild disability. And again, the whole system has been victimized, including the individual served by it, because of this erosion in services over the past 15 or 20 years. One other thing I want to say, prevention, again, like anything else, is really critical here. If a person is having issues, you want good intervention. Some of that is just good human interaction. Some of it's clinical. But we're also not doing a good job. A lot of these 600 people and others get to where they are, not because of their disability, but because the education system wasn't good to begin with. And there's not good evaluation and prevention before they reach some of these crises. So we need to work both on our preventative stuff and our reactive stuff.
Okay, and I can tell everybody wants to jump in. I haven't forgotten about you either, Professor Beasley, but Jack Rodolico, go ahead, and then a question for everybody else.
I just want to go back to the caller for a second. So you've got a parent in the state of Oregon who's happy with Lakeview. I spoke with a parent in Hawaii with a child at Lakeview who's very happy with Lakeview. the distinction here is that Lakeview has some 350 employees from what they tell me. The vast majority of those employees are good people who are trying to do a good job. What we have consistently and in many instances probably are doing the best job that they can. And I've talked with employees who say that they love the people that they work with, that they care about them genuinely. The broader issue here is that once the slightest bit of scrutiny went into Lakeview to figure out, so do those individuals always have access to that client's behavior plan? The behavior plan is that term evidence-based that we keep hearing about. You need to know what is going to trigger somebody, right? And that's all written down. And people should know that when you're stepping in to be a one-on-one with someone for 24 hours a day to be with that person, you should know what's going to make them tick. It's been shown that people at Lakeview don't always have access to that information. We also know that they are – the biggest issue at Lakeview is chronic understaffing. We know that they never have enough people to do the work that they need to. So one crisis begets another. I mean, we're talking about really serious stuff here, people disappearing in the woods for multiple days. And that kind of stuff often happens because there's a crisis over here. Everyone runs over here.
Pay
and then nobody's
to that.
Watching this
yeah.
person. And so, I mean – this has been shown again and again when you look at Lakeview at the big picture.
Well, and Jack, in one of your reports from this week, you had an interview. We're going to play a longer form of this with a gentleman named Bruce Thibodeau, a former staffer at Lakeview. And he talks about how, you know, people are sometimes just doing their best, but it's tricky. Let's hear from Bruce Thibodeau.
Bites, you know, stabbing, hits, kicks, you know, scratches. That's all part of the game.
Stabbing.
Yeah, there's been some of that, you know, in the past. Yeah. You're always on guard. You never turn your back. And sometimes when it's confrontational, there are a lot of staff that show up in case it goes south real quick. But then that in itself may be too many people. And so then you start having to back off, and then it just becomes one-on-one. And I've been in those volatile situations before. You know, we have to de-escalate that behavior.
Again, that's Bruce Thibodeau, former staffer at Lakeview, speaking to NHPR's Jack Rodolico. And Joni Beasley, you were actually asked by the state to go to Lakeview. What's your assessment of the staffing and some of the challenges that the staff there face?
I was unable to assess anything at Lakeview because they really wouldn't let me in. But I need to address a couple of things that were just said here. I think it's really important to understand that behavior, even aggression, is a form of communication. And it really isn't about knowing what triggers the aggression. It's about knowing what vulnerabilities people have, what sets the stage for the trigger to be the trigger. And one of the things that we haven't talked about are things like medical problems. Somebody died at Lakeview. They also had a medical condition. I worry about the under-treatment of medical conditions that contribute to somebody becoming aggressive. The other thing I want to say is that I almost feel like the way we're talking about the individuals at Lakeview, it's almost like we're blaming them. And I know no one means to do that, but situations like this set up a culture of violence. These are not violent people. These are not violent children. They have some primitive way of expressing themselves, and our job is to learn and to understand what it is they're telling us, and that's what best practices tell us. And one final statement about this. In the late 1980s, Herb Lovett brought me to New Hampshire from Massachusetts to see what was able to be done with people that we used to call duly diagnosed and their settings just as were just described. And we have done exceptional work in New Hampshire in this area. I'm not quite sure about why things have fallen apart, but I think it's very important to say that these challenging behaviors are not the things that need to be managed, but a better understanding of what people are communicating overall.
You know, Roy, haven't heard from you in a little while, and I did want to bring you into this, both on what Professor Beasley said, but also what Dick Cohen said earlier, that he's seen an erosion of care over the last 15 years.
Yes. What's important, I appreciate what Dr. Beasley was saying, and as Dick was referencing, community-based services, by their very nature, are part of a fabric of collaboration between various systems and various people who are there to help people. And the erosion that we have seen over time, and some of this has been addressed through previous efforts by the DRC, is we have seen in
Disability Rights Center. Again,
Disability Rights Center. Yeah. What we have seen over the past few years is a deterioration of our community mental health system. To the point where the Department of Justice filed suit against the state of New Hampshire, and we're addressing that. Those are critical partners in the community level for us to get acute a treatment locally for addressing some of these issues, and then being able to, as Dick was saying, keep them in the community. There are other elements that also are missing, but we've seen funding restrictions across the board and funding restrictions going forward, I must say, because we're talking about budget development right now. But unless these fundamental elements are addressed, like strengthening our community mental health system, addressing the ability to provide short-term intensive treatment for people, then the kind of things that are happening right now, like Jack has referenced, the governor has shut down further admissions to Lakeview, but there also has been an order by the Department of Health and Human Services to move people out of Lakeview as quickly as possible.
Everybody.
Everyone that's related to in the developmental services system.
New Hampshire residents.
In New Hampshire. What you are going to have is a prescription for – unless you're addressing those root causes, that's a prescription for more difficulty in the future.
Because there's no other place that works? Is that what you're saying?
Because those components of support that are critical to have, which includes good, strong partners in the community mental health system, are not up to par at this point because of restrictions they've had over the years.
Let me take another call, all of you. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And let's go to Bob in Amherst. Hi, Bob. You're on the air. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call. I appreciate it.
Go ahead, Bob.
I just wanted to mention that I work for Opportunity Networks in Amherst, New Hampshire. And they have job programs for clients, and we most recently worked at Johnson Precision in Hudson, New Hampshire, and their schedule is from 10 to 2:30 Monday through Thursday, and they assembled medical supplies, and they just did such a fantastic job. Market Basket also hires a lot of people with disabilities, and they're very loyal and great employees. They're terrific.
So a call, Bob, for more employers to reach out to this community of people? Is that what you're saying?
I think so. And the other thing is a lot of the funding for the program that I work for, Opportunity Networks, is community-based. They do a lot of fundraising, and there's also activities where people go bowling and have recreational activities and live the community life. It's just a terrific situation for not only the people with disabilities, but also people like myself who work as staff members.
Bob, thank you so much for calling in. What do you think, Dick Cohen?
Yeah, I just recall a story or actually a study a number of years ago in Minnesota. I was in Minnesota for about 4 years as a court monitor over a deinstitutionalization case. And there was a facility called Brainerd, and some professors went up there, and they asked for the five most notorious people at this facility who engaged in all sorts of horrendous behaviors and were in restraint and seclusion, and said, look, we're going to give these folks a job in the community. So there were these five people who went out 6 hours a day into the community and worked in a kind of an enclave with people without disabilities, working constantly. Those behaviors almost were reduced to zero.
These
behaviors that occurred daily. And, of course, when they went back to the facility at night, I mean, this wasn't a complete community placement, the behaviors resumed. So things like giving a person a communication system so they can communicate, giving a person a job, addressing some medical issue that might be causing pain and therefore aggression are all common sense things that can be done. So, but to do that, you need to have a good flourishing community service system. I want to give you one statistic in terms of how much we've devolved. In 1994, we were spending, and we don't want to use dollars and cents too much, but we were spending $75,000 per person on people with developmental disabilities. That now has gone down to $43,000, and if you take into account inflation, we're only spending $28,000 per person. So we've actually gone from $75,000 to $28,000. The cost of Lakeview is about $300,000 a year. So we're investing $300,000 per year per person in a model that doesn't work for all the reasons that we've indicated. So that I think is one reason why we've devolved. The other is HHS and the lack of oversight. We've seen really an example here of how poor oversight was over Lakeview. The lack of good standards and oversight also exists in the community. The department, which has the obligation to make sure that community facilities do well and community settings do well, I don't think has exercised their oversight authority in that regard as well, which is another reason why the system has kind of devolved and eroded.
Okay, and hang on, because I know you want to jump in, Roy. Mm-hmm. And Joan, I have another question for you, but I do have to ask you, Jack Rodolico, first. What has the state said about its oversight or, as Dick puts it, lack thereof?
So as of right now, when the Disability Rights Center reports came out in September, the governor immediately shut down a new admissions to Lakeview, and she asked the state to do two reports. One was of Lakeview, and we got that, and it confirmed this chronic staffing issue and all these other things. The other one is a sort of internal review of how HHS oversees Lakeview. So I was speaking with HHS on background on a lot of these issues, and ultimately they didn't want to talk about their oversight because they're waiting for this report to come out. So Commissioner Nick Tumpas, who's the Commissioner of Department of Health and Human Services, says that he will sit down with NHPR once that report is out. But the important thing here is that we know that a lot of oversight bodies are unhappy with how HHS handled this. Maybe we'll talk about that briefly after the break.
All right. And I will definitely go back to you, Roy Grossenberger, and you too, Joan Beasley. After a short break, you can join us too. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the system of caring for Granite Staters with developmental disabilities and some of the problems in that system. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Professor Beasley with the UNH Institute on Disability, I did want to go back to you, either get your thoughts on our caller urging employers to hire folks with developmental disabilities, and also Dick Cohen's very interesting insight into what happens when people do get out of institutional settings and into the workforce.
Well, first of all, I think it's absolutely right on the money that the most important thing to do is give people their lives. Without the ability to contribute to your own life, without natural supports and connections, the quality of your life is greatly diminished. If you have a diminished life, the possibility of being irritable increases. I think about my week with the flu, and I think about how diminished my life became and how it's a good thing my husband and I are still married this week because we both had the flu.
It's true. So, if you don't feel good, it's hard to be,
there you go.
To cope and deal.
And if you're isolated on top of not feeling good, it's a problem. I do want to say, because I have this opportunity to speak, that we are doing some things in New Hampshire that are very, very progressive, and I just want to quickly touch upon them in response to what Dick just said. We now have a clinic, an assessment clinic, operated at Dartmouth Hitchcock with highly skilled professionals for families with children and adults to refer and work with the START team, which Roy can tell you about if he'd like, out of New Hampshire.
Just real quickly, what's a START team without getting too technical?
START stands for Systemic Therapeutic Assessment Resources and Treatment. And it's a team of highly skilled professionals that are embedded in all of the area agencies that specialize in people with developmental disabilities and mental health needs to help them gain access to the right services and supports in the community, and also to teach members of the community about how to better support them. They're part of a national learning, professional learning community through the University of New Hampshire, and we've been collaborating on the development and implementation of this project over the last 4 years. In addition, Roy's agency operates the START Resource Center, which is a center where people can go to get assessment and support and also planned support in the community so that they can have the quality of life they need and deserve in the community without going to a place like Lakeview. So we're really working hard in that direction.
And all of you, I do want to go back to our listeners. Lots of folks who want to jump in our conversation. Kate's in Hudson. Hi, Kate. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I just feel like in all these conversations that I hear, people aren't drawing attention to the fact that we have kind of this grouping of children who have, you know, behaviors due to a severe mental illness, but then we have children who have a severe learning disability or a severe developmental disability, and they have the behaviors as a side effect of that. And what I've seen in a lot of different states is that there's just kind of this grouping when the behaviors reach a certain severe level. And I think it's unfortunate because you kind of see this reverse modeling that really bears a significant impact on the future of these kids. And I'm sure you probably see the same thing with adults who have this kind of differentiation. I'm not talking about a comorbidity where there's, you know, a mental illness and a developmental disability. I'm talking about where there's a clear separation, but yet the symptomology is all treated the exact same. I think that needs to be
Kate, and your phone line isn't great, but I'd love to ask you very quickly, do you have personal experience with this?
I do.
And what is that?
I'm a special ed teacher.
Yeah. Okay. Well, great to hear from you. And I hear the frustration, Roy, and the passion in her voice. You know, we're sort of putting people in silos.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Kate makes a very, very good point. The idea of segregating people with disabilities into group settings, just as Dick was saying before, it's an old model. It's an old approach, which is flawed. If you were talking about folks who have a challenge or a different way of learning, putting them together with other people who have similar challenges is not the best way. Integrating them into a group where they can be helped by their peers and engaged by their peers is the right thing to do. The other thing is, essentially we developed the concept of moving, having integrated individualized supports in the communities over 30 years ago. New Hampshire has been working on this for a very, very long time. And we have proved that this is the best way to go about it. So segregation is not the answer. Inclusion is.
Well, and another point that I hear from her call, Jack Rodolico, is this idea, and you touched on this in the beginning, but just help us out with it, that, you know, we sort of have one system for people with developmental disabilities. That's one silo. And then we have another system, which, as Dick told us, has been severely underfunded for people with mental illness. And there's been the lawsuit. And we all know about the state settling and having to cough up some more money for that. What are some of the problems that we run into when we have these sort of two definitions on paper, but there's a lot of crossover in terms of the individuals involved?
Okay, so let's do the 100-year history lesson in less than a minute, right? So, really quick, what used to happen for people with either a mental illness, which is the type of thing that often pops up later in life, and an intellectual disability, which generally you're born with, they were all institutionalized at separate institutions. And the whole country went through this process of shutting these places down. Not every state has done that, but New Hampshire was one of the first. And in that process, we created a system for people with developmental disabilities that works pretty well in New Hampshire. And part of that is because when you're born with a developmental disability, your parents become an advocate. Your family becomes an advocate. And this is a very, very strong community. And if you try to cut funding for that community, people come out of the woodwork, and for good reason, because it affects their children. Mental illness, though, has more stigma. And over the last 20 years, we've seen an erosion in the funding to help people with mental illness. So you've got two different issues, two different pots of money. But what's happening presently is you've got people that have both issues. You can have both a developmental disability, which means you have access to funding and services from birth, but then that mental illness might pop up in your teens or 20s. And even if you have even if it were me who was born without a developmental disability, if I developed a mental illness when I was 16, it might take me 2 or 3 years to get it fully diagnosed. In that time, I could develop some pretty bad behaviors. I could become addicted to cigarettes. I could get involved in the criminal justice system. So it becomes very complicated very quickly when you have both issues. And that is often, again, Lakeview is a symptom of where that is a problem nationally. And this is not Lakeview's fault per se. This is people wind up there when the local system gives out. And that's why you see people at Lakeview from Vermont, Maine, New Hampshire, New York, Oregon, Hawaii, Pennsylvania, and other states.
All right.
Can I just
ahead real quickly, Professor Beasley.
This is a national problem. This is a population where there is no national policy, no national research funding, no national standards to support this particular population. And one of the things to distinguish, and it would take an entire show to try to do this, is the vulnerabilities associated with having a developmental disability, the psychological vulnerabilities, and mental illness. They're two different things. So not everybody who has developmental issues, who has aggression, is mentally ill, and not everybody who has developmental disabilities, who has aggression, is not mentally ill. It depends. And there's much, much more to it, and there's no standards. So that's what we're seeing, no standards. And the issue is that there's no training in medical schools, there's no training in schools of psychology in this field in the United States. In Europe, it's a different story, and they do a much better job as a result.
Okay. Dick Cohen, you want to jump in? Then we'll go back to our callers.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the higher ed issue is a whole other program as well, and I agree with that. But in some ways, there are not – on the federal level, it is a kind of a hodgepodge. We actually have a fairly good set of standards in New Hampshire, various regulations which at least in theory address a lot of these issues. In practice, it doesn't happen. And I agree with the sentiment that there people with developmental disabilities may have behavioral issues, but by virtue – it's associated with their disability, their developmental disability, a lack of ability to communicate, et cetera. It's not necessarily mental illness.
But the behaviors that are exhibited as a result of that are often interpreted as mental illness?
That's right. And I think the collapse of the mental health system has been a problem, not just for people with developmental disabilities, and we've been involved in that lawsuit as well. But the way the system is designed is that if you have a developmental disability, that's your primary disability, you go into the DD system, the developmental disability system, like Roy's program, and then there's an assessment like a START assessment or whatever, and then if it's determined that it's primarily developmental disability or being isolated or whatever, you address it. If you have a diagnosable mental illness like psychosis or schizophrenia, then you should be able to access the mental health system just like a person without a developmental disability. There is, I would agree, a problem in accessing that mental health system, and the problem there is the leadership, again, at the Department of Health and Human Services. The department that oversees both the mental health system and the developmental disability system could, with proper leadership, bridge that gap for folks who are truly mentally ill as well as developmentally disabled. They have failed in that for the past 20 to 30 years.
Is it leadership or is it funding?
It's a combination of both, but good leadership, I think, could lead to bridging it and also to more funding.
Okay,
and
that
hasn't been there.
And super short to you, Roy, and then back to our callers.
Super short. We're in the funding season right now for the state budget. There's the House Bill 1 is 4% reduction for developmental services. The House Finance Committee is talking about 20% reduction beyond that. There's a hearing this afternoon that people should attend. But the other is there's three components. There is a mental health. There's funding reform that has to happen, and there also has to be a tweaking of our regulations with regard to certification and licensure in order to address intensive treatment.
Go ahead, Dick,
caller. The irony is while the department is now sort of talking about improving places like Lakeview and the community system, what we're witnessing is actually further erosion by virtue of this budget.
Okay, one more caller, Eileen in New Durham. Go ahead, you're on The Exchange. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Laura. I think I'd like to make a comment, if that would be all right. I worked at Laconia State School from 1974 until it was deinstitutionalized. Then I went to New Hampshire Hospital and worked in the rehab department for about 15 years. And then I brought a woman home to live with us. She stayed with us for 15 years.
Wow, Eileen, it's a long experience in this. Go ahead, yeah.
Well, I loved her. She was she had a dual diagnosis, which is drugs, alcohol, cigarettes, and mental illness. She had had a very, very hard life. But just recently, I had to file for guardianship from the state to get help with her. I never received any help. I never asked for any, but not a penny, and no support. So I just like to make that comment that maybe people need to reach out to the community and say good job, you know?
Yeah. Eileen, well, we'll say good job. Thank you very much for doing that for her and for calling in today. I think you want to jump in, Dick, and then we'll wrap up.
Sure. Yeah, just one quick thing. The reference to Laconia reminded me of this point. There are parents out there who feel safe with places like Lakeview that are large and brick and mortar. And I was involved in the Laconia State lawsuit many years ago. And many of the parents, in fact, probably a majority, as bad as the conditions were at Laconia, didn't want to see their children placed in the community. They were very fearful. And because the community system almost didn't exist at that point. And, of course, if we listened to the majority of the parents, Laconia would still be there and we'd still have the conditions and people wouldn't be flourishing or living in the community. So parents, understandably, can get, particularly where they're frustrated with an eroding system, whether that's in Oregon, New Hampshire, or elsewhere, are very fearful of what the result will be. So I agree with Roy. We need to make sure that the community system is sufficiently beefed up so we don't need a place like Lakeview and we can allay these parents' concerns and fears.
And just to remind everybody, I mean, Jack touched on this, but Laconia is the big institution that existed for 100 years and then under deinstitutionalization, people
closed.
Were right.
Can I just say one?
I'd love to hear from you, Professor
comment.
Beasley. Yeah.
I just want to say that in conclusion, if you treat people with humanity, they become more ordinary. And, you know, so that's just sort of the way it is.
Say that again, Professor Beasley, because that's kind of a profound point. Go ahead.
If you treat people with humanity, they become more ordinary.
So it's in our own interest, you're saying?
It's in our own interest. They're members of our community. They're people just like we are. And they really need to be treated like you'd want your sister, your brother, yourself to be treated. That's really what this is all about. And this is what the legislature needs to attend to. These are citizens of New Hampshire that are entitled to be treated like humans.
I have a very specific question for you, Roy, and then Jack will ask sort of what your next reports are going to be about because this story is not over. Someone mentioned earlier, Roy, that Lakeview is not going to take any more New Hampshire residents. So what happens to those people who are there now? Where do they go? Do they come to Community Bridges and your folks or what?
We have the area agencies have been given direction to find alternatives to Lakeview. And to do that as soon as possible.
In the state? Do they exist in the state? Because it seemed like from what Jack said, Lakeview was filling a need that nobody else was filling.
It was filling a need, and area agencies are needing to find an alternative. That's simply the directive that was given. There needs to be addressing of a root causes, which is the funding reform, the regulatory component, and the acute mental health access in the local community. We need to address those root causes, not simply order them to return and try to cover up the issue. But that is some action that we need to – is the second step of the good steps that the governor and the commissioner has taken.
Okay. And, Jack, your two stories are online at nhpr.org, but there's more.
Yeah. I mean, so what's next, right? So for Lakeview, you know, they're still in heavy, heavy reviews with Department of Health and Human Services and the Department of Education. We'll see where those go. We know that states are pulling their residents, but we also know that there's big looming questions over the Department of Health and Human Services. New York was unhappy with the way they've regulated. You know, many parents have been unhappy with the way they regulated. So really the question is, what's next for the Department of Health and Human Services?
And I know you'll be following up with other stories once that investigation
That's right.
comes out. And Dick Cohen, real quick.
The reason why I'm optimistic is because when Laconia was under court order and the state decided to shut it down, there were 600 people, many with severe disabilities, and there was no service system. Within 4 or 5 years, a great service system was developed to place not just 30 people, which is what exists at Lakeview in terms of New Hampshire residents, but 500 people. So we can do it. We've
done
it
before.
In the 80s. We can do it now.
Okay. Good to end on an optimistic note. And Dick Cohen, Professor Beasley, Roy Gerstenberger, Jack Rodolico, thank you all very much. Really
thank
appreciate
you.
It.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Jason Moon. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. And I'm Laura Kamen.